welcome to FICPE's podcast series, FICPE Focus 45. FICPE is the only international NGO whose membership consists entirely of IP attorneys in private practice. The FICPE global community is driven by a shared interest among like-minded people to promote common solutions and advocacy for private practice. The FICPE business family makes the world a little bit smaller, bringing independent IP attorneys from around the globe together to focus on IP issues of global importance. Our host is Louis-Pierre Gravel, a registered patent agent and partner at Bereskin & Parr in Montreal, Canada.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to FICPE's webinar and podcast series, FICPE Focus 45. My name is Louis-Pierre Gravel, and I'm a partner at Bereskin & Parr in Montreal, Canada. We are absolutely delighted today to have our first return guest to our program, the Honorable Paul Michel, Chief Judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, now retired. Appointed in 1988 to the court, he became Chief Judge in 2004, stepping down in 2010 after more than 22 years on the court. During that time, Judge Michel sat on thousands of appeals and wrote over 800 opinions, about a third of which were in patent cases. Since leaving the bench, Judge Michel has continued to be active, being a frequent speaker on IP topics, testifying before Congress on patent reform legislation, and writing articles and blog posts. He is a recipient of numerous awards from various organizations, named one of the 50 most influential leaders in IP by Managing Intellectual Property magazine, and inducted into the Intellectual Asset Management magazine's International Hall of Fame. It is a great honor for me to welcome you again to our series of podcasts. Thank you very much, Judge Michel.
Thank you for once again teaming with me for a 45-minute educational session. I'm thrilled to be reconnected with FICPE, which is a great organization doing wonderful work in the world.
Thank you very much. That's very kind of you. We greatly appreciate you sharing your time to come with us. And today's topic is going to be what are colloquially known as march-in rights under the Bayh-Dole Act. And so maybe we can start a little bit by saying, well, what are marching rights?
Well, the Bayh-Dole Act was passed by the U.S. Congress in 1980. It was meant to remedy a problem whereby federally funded inventions never got to the marketplace because the government couldn't develop them into products and manufacture and distribute them. And the government was unable to get partners in the private sector to do so because the government retained ownership of the patents. So the Bayh-Dole Act changed that and allowed the recipient of the government grants, usually research universities or other laboratories, to themselves take out the patents and then to license the patents on an exclusive basis to a well-chosen industry partner to commercialize the upstream scientific discovery or invention. Before the Bayh-Dole Act was passed, almost none of the federally funded inventions got to consumers, less than 5%. In the four decades plus since the Bayh-Dole Act has been in force, something like 85% of the government funded discoveries or inventions get to consumers. And it's because of this public-private partnership that the exclusive patent right makes possible for the private actor to participate in this role. And it's been a huge success. The Economist magazine from London said that the Bayh-Dole Act was the most inspired and beneficial piece of legislation passed by the American Congress in over half a century.
So the underlying philosophy is to say, well, so we've got all this federally funded research. It's being done by universities mostly, but we need to be able to take that research, crystallize it into IP assets, and then put it in the hands of entrepreneurs or businesses who can then take the research and commercialize it and make commercially viable products out of it.
Exactly right. And the basic economics are worth a specific mention. The research grants that go to universities are usually in the range of $10 or $20 million. But the cost to develop a product and actually get it to the marketplace usually runs 100 to 1,000 times higher. So the private money that has to be encouraged to enter the activity means the incentives have to be high because that's the only way the risks can be justified. And that was the genius of the Buy-Dole Act. It encouraged massive investment of private capital in taking these university research discoveries and turning them into actual drugs and other products made available to consumers in the marketplace. It's worked so beautifully that it's been the foundation of the surge in advance by the U.S. biotech industry in the decades since Buy-Dole. Before Buy-Dole, European countries led by far in this area of technology. And since Buy-Dole, the U.S. has eclipsed everybody by quite a bit. And something like 80% of the new drugs discovered in recent decades have been discovered in the U.S. And I think this is directly attributable to the genius of the Buy-Dole Act.
The Buy-Dole Act then provides this mechanism where private enterprise can have access to exclusive IP rights in the form of patents. So what are the margin rights then? How does that come into play?
Well, since the goal of the Buy-Dole Act was to actually get products to consumers, there was some concern when the act was passed that, well, what if the university doesn't seek a partner to commercialize the invention? Or what if the partner just sits on his hands and doesn't actually work to produce a product and get it to consumers? So for that circumstance, they provided for the ability of the government to claim ownership of the patent that had actually been obtained by the research university and licensed to the entrepreneur. But it was clearly intended to be sure that the progress toward a product in the marketplace was ongoing. And if it wasn't, then the whole arrangement could be disentangled. But they never had to use these rights, the government didn't. And the reason was because the universities make money from the licensing, and they depend on that to fund their labs and their research and their faculty salaries and so on. So they were very careful to monitor the progress of their chosen private sector entrepreneur or company, and to make sure there was a steady march toward producing the product and getting it to a consumer. So that's the only reason the march-in powers existed, and they never had to be used because there was never a lack of commercialization progress.
As you said, Buy-Dole was enacted by in the 1980s. You've said just now that this march-in right provision was never used. So why are we talking about this now?
Well, in the U.S., there is a political uproar over the cost of some patented drugs. In certain cases, the prices can be quite high. And so some years ago, a few academics cooked up a theory that the march-in rights could be expanded and used to control the price of drugs, not just the availability of drugs. The Act mentions accessibility, but not price. But right. The academic article said, well, if you can't afford the price, then you don't really have adequate access. So that must be what they meant. It was clearly not what they meant. And the two senators have testified and written articles over the decades saying, no, price control was not even in contemplation, was not the intent of the act. Access to products in the marketplace is all that we were aiming at. But suddenly, the present presidential administration under Joseph Biden decided they wanted to use this academic theory, even though it had been soundly debunked by other academics, to justify a price control regime, particularly aimed at drugs, but applicable to every technology and every federal grant-making agency, of which there are 20. National Institutes of Health, I think, is the most common grantor, but there are 19 others. And now they're all being encouraged to march in if they consider the price, quote, unreasonable, end quote, even though that's not authorized by the act. and has never been done. So it's actually quite an extraordinary development, particularly by an administration that only 1 year ago rejected a march-in petition on the exact grounds that the Baidoa-elect didn't give the government authority to march in the circumstance of price.
So there's like a complete reverse course from the administration on this.
Within 1 year, a complete reverse course, and it was done by a very secretive interagency task force. There is no justification in terms of a cost-benefit analysis. There's no justification in terms of a legal opinion that the authority actually exists. It was done without involvement of the Justice Department that normally vets the legality of new programs, or of the Patent Office, which is where all the expertise in patents in our government is. They weren't involved at all. And we don't know who was involved because it was all done in secret. The guidance was announced January 23rd. They provided an extremely short period filled with major holidays for people to make comments. The comments were all due not later than February 6th. Many people did comment. Many others complained they didn't have enough time to evaluate the complicated proposal and submit useful comments. And the guidance not only purports to justify seizing patents from the licensee and the university based on price, but it also covers any other terms of the private sale between the manufacturer and the consumer, and it covers every technology and every agency. If you look at the latter part of the document, it has seven or eight scenarios, different factual circumstances where it claims that march-in would be appropriate. And they cover things like clean energy and many other things beyond drugs, even though the public relations part of it put all emphasis on drug prices.
Right. So this follows what I think was a statement by the Biden administration regarding its intent to address the issue of what is perceived to be extremely high drug prices in the United States. So there's an underlying coherence in terms of argument that this follows what the Biden administration is targeting. So let's step back a little bit. If we look at it a little bit more objectively, how many drugs could actually be targeted by this potential march-in right from an agency?
Yeah, very, very few. So ironically, it's a power grab, in my opinion. It's unlawful, and it actually would do almost nothing to help the perceived problem. And the reason is that, first of all, most drugs are now on generic manufacturer and not patented manufacturer. Over 93% of prescriptions are filled with generic drugs. Of the other 7%, most were privately financed, and therefore Baidoa has zero application to those cases. And even where some of the patents covering a drug involve federal funding in the upstream scientific research, other patents covering the same drug were privately financed. So those too would not be available for Baidoa. So out of the 361 most common drugs on the World Health Organization list, only about a handful or two would even potentially be subject to a march-in. So the new guidance is essentially futile because it would do very, very little good. Now, I want to quickly add, for those people whose out-of-pocket costs for a very expensive drug are unaffordable, given their financial circumstances, there is a real problem and there should be a real solution. But it shouldn't be to seize private property patents from the universities who depend on them financially or from the licensees who are commercializing them. The answer is to change the insurance arrangements to reduce the out-of-pocket costs of people who need expensive medicines. So this is the wrong solution to a limited but real problem.
Would you characterize this as using a very large sledgehammer to try to squash a really tiny insect?
Well, that would be one colorful way to put it. Now, I think it's accurate enough. I would actually take a more cynical view. Since this is a 180-degree reversal by this same administration, as you pointed out a minute ago, what intervened? Well, what intervened were two things. A very close election season ending in November of this year, number one, and number two, demands from a few people in Congress, two senators and a number of representatives, to use the Bayh-Dole Act to control drug prices. So it looks to me like this is basically a political gesture in response to the congressional letters. And in response to a very close presidential election where the administration looks to me to be desperate to appeal to every imaginable group to try to get their votes. So I think it's not too cynical to say this is basically an election year public relations stunt.
Interesting. I mean, we could have a long conversation about whether or not this is actually a stunt and what are the politics involved in this. But let's go back to the topic at hand, which is assuming that this is a rational, objective public policy measure, what would be the upsides to a mechanism like this one, potentially?
Well, other than the potential, until courts struck it down, to lower the price of a few drugs, I don't see any upside. And the downside is enormous because it would destroy this entire financing system that was created by the Bayh-Dole Act and has been so successful, as the economist noted. So if you do a back-of-the-envelope cost-benefit analysis, this proposal has tiny benefits and incalculably huge costs, because it dries up all the private sector money that was the very way of getting the laboratory research into products for consumers, including drugs.
Is this a potential downside, or have we already seen private money dry up or reduce the flow of investment towards university?
We're already seeing that, and it's no surprise, because that was exactly what the private sector people said before Bayh-Dole. They said the federal grant money is toxic. If we work on an invention that has any federal money in the upstream research, we're going to lose out. And that's why they wouldn't touch it. So it once again makes supporting university discoveries and getting them into products toxic from the perspective of the outside companies and their investors. So it's going to immediately dry up when it's implemented, and it's already beginning to dry up the private sector money going into particularly the pharmaceutical and biotech arena.
The underlying legislative authority for this lies in the Bayh-Dole Act. I haven't looked at it, but I'm sure there's a series of regulations that have been enacted or promulgated to support the mechanics of the Act. But what we're talking about here is not actually regulation. It's called a framework, which doesn't have the same kind of legal support, I suppose.
I think you're right. It's a different legal category, and I think it was chosen in order to avoid challenging lawsuits. Because if they issued it as a regulation, it would immediately be challenged in court. And my prediction is it would be struck down. So by avoiding the formality of the regulatory process, the people behind this are hoping to get the at least political benefit out of it without necessarily being challenged. So it's possible it will never be implemented if it's only a political gesture. On the other side of the coin, if it is implemented, there'll be an immediate lawsuit. And it's very clear in the law that if the government seizes a patent and gives it over to other people, like generic drug makers or anyone else, the government has to pay for it, and they have to pay the full value of it. And so taxpayers are going to be on the hook for many billions of dollars if this so-called authority is actually implemented. So it's a very counterproductive proposal that's going to hurt the universities, hurt patients because the products will never get developed and put on the shelves. And it will hurt the taxpayers who will have to pay for these private property seizures under U.S. law that's well settled.
So I imagine from a federal and perhaps a state level, there are a variety of expropriation laws that are on the books already. However, the particular framework we're talking about is completely silent as to compensation. And so how do those two sets of potentially overlapping rules work together?
Well, that's a very good question, and it seems not to have been contemplated by the framers of this guidance. But the law is very clear. There's a statute that has a number 1498, and it provides that if the government, for good and sufficient reason, seizes an exclusive patent and lets others manufacture it, they have the power to do that, but they have to pay the patent owner fair and full compensation. So that law has been on the books since World War I. It remains on the books, and it overshadows this new guidance framework. But the guidance framework sort of pretends that Section 1498 doesn't exist. So it's just silent on the issue of who's going to pay the bill at the end of the day.
Well, certainly it appears that if this guidance is followed and an agency does step in to exercise its rights, whether or not it's a framework or a regulation, there will most likely be litigation involved in trying to sort this out. Do you think there's and I know we're speculating, you know, we're crystal ball gazing, but do we think there's a legitimate intention from the White House or from any of the agencies to actually enforce their march-in rights?
Well, I would say they don't have any march-in rights for the purpose of price control. But putting that aside, who knows? They have all these comments, despite the shortness of the comment period that ended in early February. They have to analyze them, which I'm sure they will. Then they have to decide whether to change their guidance. I predict they won't change the guidance. So then the guidance is in the hands of the 20 agencies that provide grant money to universities and other labs. So I guess it's an open invitation for any and every such government agency to march in anytime its employees decide they think the price or other sale term is not reasonable.
So that's an interesting point. Does the framework provide for any of the agencies sua sponte to exercise march-in rights, or do they need to do this in response to a petition, or what's the mechanism to get an agency involved in this?
Yeah, good question. The mechanism, which has already been used many times but always rejected on the grounds that price control was not authorized by the Bayh-Dole Act, is a petition, just as you say. So the guidance provides that the petition can be filed with the grant-making agency by anyone, even a foreign government, even a hostile power, even a company's competitor. So the competitor of the exclusive licensee to one of these inventions can file a petition. And then the patent owner or licensee has to defend against the petition, which costs a lot of money to hire lawyers to defend and starts a long process that could easily last, I'm estimating, a year or even 2 years. And meanwhile, progress stops and funding dries up. So it's not a happy prospect, and there's no limit on the number of petitions that can be filed, just as there's no limit on who can file them. And I am unaware of any competence or experience or expertise in any of these 20 agencies to evaluate the market price of the licensed patent in question. So I don't see how they can do this rationally. But so it will be subjective, you know, whatever some bureaucrat says he thinks is unreasonable. Maybe anything more than $1 could be considered unreasonable.
Right. And that was going to be my follow-up question. Do we know if the various agencies that are funding this research, do they have the staff to be able to evaluate these petitions and make a reasonable or even an unreasonable determination?
Not to my knowledge.
And is there, does the framework provide a timeline for a decision to be issued or for the agency to arrive at some sort of a conclusion based on a petition?
No, there's no timeline. There's no detail of what the process would entail. They'll have to make it up as they go along. In the past, they handled these petitions effectively and sometimes expeditiously because the only issue was, does the authority exist? And the agents would say, no, price control authority doesn't exist, petition denied. But now they'll be answering a different question, is the price or some other sale term reasonable? And it's not defined at all. It's totally subjective. And so who knows how it will be applied. And it very possibly will be applied very inconsistently from one of these 20 grant-making agencies to the next to the next.
Right, because the framework doesn't provide any sort of guidelines or directives in terms of how this should be evaluated, right?
Exactly. It does not. And that's another serious flaw or omission in the thinking of the people in this interagency secret task force that produced this guidance. It was formally issued by the National Standards Institute that we call NIST, but I don't think that they will change the guidance that the interagency group came up with. And so it's going to be in the hands of the agencies what to do.
Exactly. There's so many questions that I have. You mentioned earlier when draft regulations or draft legislation is contemplated by the administration or by Congress, typically the various agencies or various government actors would be consulted and at least be able to provide some guidance or some opinion on it. You mentioned earlier that other agencies like the USPTO or like Justice weren't consulted. Do we know that for a fact? Or is it because this process has been cloaked in some secrecy that we don't know?
No legal opinion by the Justice Department, the normal agency to issue such evaluations, is referred to in the documentation. So I deduce from that Justice was not consulted, even though normally they would be. No awareness on the part of the patent office director or participation in this process is referred to. So again, I'm assuming that Director Vidal was not part of the task force and had no say in what this group did. So we don't know absolutely for sure, but it would be the normal thing for the guidance to explain the legal basis and who vetted the legality of it and who did the cost-benefit analysis and what its results were. Not one word on any of those topics appears in the guidance.
So under a variety of different democratic institutions around the world, there is freedom to access legislation that exists to allow taxpayers or citizens to ask the government for some information regarding some of its deliberations. Have access to information requests been filed in respect of the establishment of this framework?
Yes, several were filed, and the filings pointed out that the comment period was very, very short, unusually truncated, and that the whole thing seemed to have been done in secret. And therefore, they asked for who did it, what were their evaluations, what were the documents, who were they consulting in terms of outside sources. And the requesters also asked for the evaluation of their request to be expedited, and that was immediately refused by NIST. So it'll take 6 or 8 or 10 months or longer to even get an answer to the Freedom of Information Act request. And very often the answers reveal almost nothing from what the requesters are really asking about. So I'm not optimistic that we'll learn the real story here.
We'll have another discussion on the freedom to access information. There was a recent report that in Canada's Globe and Mail, which is a national newspaper, about how the Canadian government is particularly opaque when it comes to its deliberations and releasing information. So I can imagine for a touchy subject like this one, the administration and its various agencies would be even more reluctant to be forthcoming with information.
I expect you're correct.
This is a framework, so it's not really now open to litigation because you can't challenge a framework before the courts before it's actually implemented. The only way this would be reviewed in some way is if one of the agencies, and probably NIST would be the first one because it's probably more interested in the result of this, for lack of a better word. So if they do take advantage of these march-in rights, following a petition, following a decision from the agency that they are in fact going to march in and seize the patent or patents, what would, and I think you've said this already, but according to you, the next step would be immediate litigation.
Absolutely. I think it's 100% certain that the first patent that gets seized will be challenged in court, and the whole regime will be challenged. And if the challenge fails, the licensee or patent-owning university will demand compensation in a separate. So there'll be multiple litigations, and they'll be immediate, and they'll be very expensive if my prediction is correct, that the government is on the hook for expropriating the private property. The Patent Act explicitly says that a patent is a form of personal property. Mm-hmm. And under settled U.S. law, the government cannot seize personal property under any circumstance without paying for it. And there are limited circumstances where they can seize it to begin with. An obvious example is if the military needs to buy a weapon and some of its components are covered by patents, they are authorized to let other people make the parts rather than the patentee having the exclusive right to do so, but they have to pay. So there's no doubt there'll be multiple lawsuits immediately, and there also will be appeals from the denial that I expect of the Freedom of Information Act request. So there'll be litigation about that as well. So there's going to be litigation all over the place if this is implemented. And if it isn't implemented, it looks to me like it's a black eye for the administration, because they have so much hoopla and publicity about how they're going to try to control drug prices and other prices of various technologies by seizing patents. And then if they don't do it, then how are they going to explain why they're not doing it? They suddenly don't care about price control. They've put themselves in a bit of a bind, I think. If they implement, they are facing huge and very adverse litigation risks. And if they don't do it, the press is going to, and the Congress is going to demand, then why aren't you doing it? You announced all this and now you're not doing it.
It's interesting that you've been using the word implementing. So I suppose these were draft guidelines that were published earlier this year?
Correct.
So draft guidelines, they were open for comment for a very short period of time. In a typical process, the next step would be for the government to respond to the comments and then set a date for implementation. Is that how it would work?
Well, I think first they will finalize the guidance. Okay. And I expect with little or no change. And then it's on the desk of the agency head. Here's what you're supposed to do, because we say so. Right. So then the question becomes, all right, the first petition that gets filed, what does the NIH director do? Does the director grant the petition and expropriate the patents or deny it? And it seems clear that the whole point of the guidance is to tell the head of NIH and counterpart officials, seize the patents.
Right. Now, the issue that is allegedly addressed by this framework is the high cost of some, not all, drugs that are available on the U.S. market. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think this framework would have any extraterritorial effects. In other words, this would have nothing to do with the high prices of drugs in, say, Africa or sub-Saharan countries.
Correct, because patent law is essentially territorial. So patents in other countries are the business of those other countries, just like patents in the United States or Canada are the business of those jurisdictions. So it doesn't solve the problem of the third world, as it's sometimes referred to. And it doesn't really even solve the problem within the U.S., in my opinion. It's really quite startling. And one other thing is that the Congress enacted the law. It's never changed the law. It's been in force for 43 years. Suddenly, the law is being, quote, reinterpreted, but basically rewritten by bureaucrats in the executive branch. And in U.S. legal system, the executive branch doesn't have the power to rewrite legislation. It only has the power to implement legislation as written by the Congress. So you have unelected bureaucrats who are rewriting a statute passed by the Congress and never changed. If the Congress wanted to make the Bayh-Dole Act a vehicle for price control, it presumably could do that by amending the Bayh-Dole Act, but it's never been amended. There, as far as I know, there isn't even a proposal to amend it. So this is an end run around the Bayh-Dole Act regime.
Some outside observers of U.S. politics might reply to that and say, well, Congress over the past few years, maybe decades, has been unable to effectively pass any legislation. And so the administration's only way of trying to advance public policy measures is to go through this type of framework or executive decisions. What would you respond to that?
Well, the record is quite to the contrary. The Congress recently passed a very major technology bill called the CHIPS and Science Act to invest in fabrication facilities to create advanced computer chips. They have increased the amount of money to go into grants, to go to universities and other labs. So it's just not true that the Congress can't pass legislation. It's passed numerous important pieces of legislation in the area of economics and technology. And in any event, if the will of the people is not to change a law, why is that a valid complaint? To not pass a new law is an expression of the will of the people, just as to pass a new law is an expression of the will of the people, as implemented by their elected representatives. So if Congress does, if chooses not to change the Bayh-Dole Act, why isn't that perfectly legitimate in a democratic society as a proper choice for the Congress? Change it or don't change it. Up to you. You have the power.
There is another question that did come up in our chat regarding the very highly mediatized issue surrounding waivers with respect to COVID medicines that reared its head a few years ago. Do you think this particular framework follows in the same footsteps as what has been characterized by some as an anti-patent stance following the issue of COVID waivers?
Yeah, I think it's very much in the same mold. And the COVID waivers turned out to be completely hollow because the problem wasn't patents. The problem was that the impoverished countries were unable to use the vaccines that were supplied to them because they didn't have facilities for storage and refrigeration and distribution and adequate nurses and so forth. So patents weren't the problem on the vaccines, nor with regard to the later proposal, the therapeutics to treat people who actually got COVID. It's the same thing. The patents aren't the problem. The problem is a lack of healthcare infrastructure in the countries that are complaining. And seizing patents or waiving the obligations under the TRIPS treaty won't solve the problem.
And is there a link or a coherence in thought between the COVID waivers, between this particular framework, and the ongoing Section 101 issues with respect to patentable subject matter? Are we can we look at all of these from very far and say, this is a trend that is having an impact on the legitimacy of the patent system as a whole?
Absolutely. The patent system in the United States for the last 18 years has been under a sustained and increasing attack from all sides, dealing with eligibility, dealing with the availability of injunctions for proven infringement, dealing with other patent doctrines like obviousness. In the courts and in the Congress that created this new tribunal in the patent office to invalidate patents, there have been attacks and they're increasing and they all have the same flavor that everything should be free and patents are bad because patents mean products aren't free. Of course, if you don't have the product at any price because the drug never got made, what good is it that there's a scientific discovery at some famous research university? If it can't be turned into a product, it's useless. And so it's very myopic for people to say, well, I want cheap drugs because it'll mean there won't be any new drugs at any price. And the new drugs are always better than the older drugs. That's the advance of science. And they're better in many different ways. Fewer side effects, more curative power, easier administration. You no longer have to go to a hospital to have an infusion. You can take a pill, et cetera, et cetera. So the progress of medicine is going to come to a screeching halt. And it's the opposite of what any society needs.
One might even want to pull that argument further and to say this is perhaps yet one more step in the direction of an anti-science stance that we have seen emerge in some various corners of the world.
I hadn't thought of that, but I don't think that sounds like a far-fetched thought. There's clearly a huge anti-patent move afoot in the United States from many sources. And it's also reflected in the copyright area, where a lot of people think copyrights raise prices and shouldn't be allowed, and that therefore almost anything should be considered an exception to the copyright power, so-called fair use. So IP rights are under siege from many sources, and all kinds of IP rights, but particularly patents. And I think part of this is because of some abusive conduct by a small number of, very small number of people. You may recall there was a gentleman by the name of Martin Shkreli, who bought a company that had a patent for some important drug. I forget the name of it. And then he boosted the price by like 5,000% or something like that overnight. Well, he went to jail. He's in jail today, serving a prison sentence for multiple big crimes. So to me, this proves our current legal system actually works. That's the way to control abusive conduct, not eviscerating the whole patent system that's critical to the financing of progress of science, the very phrase that appears in our Constitution as the purpose of the patent system.
Exactly. Thank you very much for this very entertaining conversation and very informative conversation. I have one last question, which is a little bit off topic, but as an astute observer of the patent public policy around the world, and we touched just recently now on the COVID waivers, do you feel that we're seeing a comeback for the waivers through the pandemic preparedness treaty?
Oh, sure. I mean, people keep trying. You know, if one initiative fails, they just try another initiative. That's going on globally and domestically here in the U.S. And it will continue to go on because it's being incentivized by certain economic forces that want to see no patents or the weakest possible patents. And they're spending billions of dollars in lobbying and campaign contributions and public relations firms. So there's a war on patents going on in the United States, and it's very well coordinated, very well funded, extremely effective, and it's causing progressively greater harm every year.
Judge Michelle, again, I want to thank you very, very much for your time today. It's been great to have you back on our podcast. I hope I have the opportunity to speak to you again in the context of another podcast at some point. But thank you very, very much again. It was a great conversation. And for those of us who are listening, please keep your eyes out on the FICP webpage and social media to see the dates and topics for our next editions. Thank you very much, everyone. Have a great day. Judge Michelle, always a pleasure.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
If you have any questions about the topics discussed in this podcast, you can sign up for free and message us, ficp.org. You can also find out more of what's to come on the FICP Focus 45 podcast series, either on the events page of our website, LinkedIn, or via our newsletter. See you next time.